Hey guys, welcome to the show. How are you doing? How am I doing? I'm doing good. I can't really hear you when you answer me, so I'll just pretend that you said good and asked me how I am. It's the start of the show. It always starts off a little clunky, but that's all right. Later on, I'll get upset. Hey, Danny Mueller is going to be on. Yeah, that's going to be upsetting. Danny Mueller. I need to Google the hell out of him, don't I? I got a little bit of information, but I need more. Danny Mueller is going to be on the show to talk about clean drinking water for the Gazans and other related matters. He has a lot of experience in these questions. And let me see. There's a lot of Danny Muellers in the world here. Is it Mueller? Mueller? Gaza and water and see what we get then. All right. So I need a... Oh, here we go. Here's an article at Counterpunch. That's bound to have a good bio attached to it, right? Down at the bottom, let's see. I should always do this kind of thing live. Yes, he's from, he's worked with the Middle East Children's Alliance ever since the 1990s, and with Voices in the Wilderness, too, Kathy Kelly's group. Great. Okay. So he's going to be on to talk about, the innocent victims of Israel's pogrom in Gaza. Ray McGovern is going to be on to talk about picking a fight with Russia here. People say they're causing a new Cold War, but I don't know. Why not worse? The veteran intelligence professionals for sanity have a new memo to the president out regarding the shoot down of the plane. Talk about some broader context, too. I'll get back to the news in a second. Also, Ken Klippenstein. Is it Steen or Stein? I don't know yet. Ken Klippenstein. I'm going to guess it's Stein. I have no idea. It's a 50-50 chance, right? Ken Klippenstein from Truthout is going to be on to talk about how the USA has armed Israel to the teeth for their wars against the helpless civilians in their canned hunt, in their barrel shoot. And he's going to get detailed on us and explain just how much and just how bad. It's going to be a great show today on the show. Oh, man, you know what? I'm sorry, guys. I've been so busy this morning and so far behind. I think McClatchy, whoever puts together McClatchy's morning newsletter does a really terrible job, right? They miss stories entirely. And then what also they do is they put in the same stories over and over and over again, just in one email. Literally, you'll have the same story, you know, their morning and afternoon email alert. You have the same story in there five times in each different section or whatever. But meanwhile, important stories have come out that don't get in there at all. So really, the smart thing to do is to go and check out the website and just to make sure. If I remember, I'm writing a note to myself. If I remember at the break, I'm going to send an email to Mitchell Prothero. He's in Iraq still. And I know that I asked him a bunch of stuff that I wanted to ask him about, and some of which he had written about, but I didn't really give him a chance to talk about all what he wanted to talk about last time on the show. Well, he did, yeah, we went off and talked all about the religious bigotry of ISIS and their destruction of all the Christian and Shiite shrines and this kind of thing. But anyway, I want to know more about what's going on with the Islamic State right now in Syria and in Iraq and all of that. So I'm going to try to send an email to Mitchell and see if we can get him back on the show for later. I've been trying to arrange Ramzi Baroud to come back on the show to talk about Gaza, but we've just been having time conflicts there. And I've been trying to get Ali Abunima from Electronic Intifada. And, you know, I should have been interviewing this guy all these years. I don't know why I haven't been interviewing him all these years. I like that guy. I like his site, and I like his articles. And I had fun watching him thrash J.J. Goldberg from the Forward on Democracy Now! The other day. Although I wish he had cited J.J. Goldberg in his recent article accusing Netanyahu of knowing the three boys were dead and dishonestly pretending they were still alive and holding out hope for the Israeli people and for the kids' parents in order to drum up all this hate and hostility and mass raids against Hamas and the provocations that led to the current crisis. He could have said yes. Even JJU conceded that Netanyahu drummed up this entire GD thing, pal. That would have made a great talking point. But otherwise, it was a wonderful debate to see. Well, just because of the, you know, he's strident. You don't get to see a real strident defense of the Palestinian position. And not of the Hamas position, but the Palestinian position. An unapologetic one. You know, I saw James, is it James? I forget which Zogby is which. One of them is the pollster, so he's very acceptable in D.C. The other one is his brother, is a Palestinian activist. But because his brother is the Zogby pollster guy, he has a little bit better access than the average, you know, Arab to get on TV and to say a point of view. And I guess, I assume he's a right-wing Republican, too, some kind of conservative, too, which makes him a little bit more acceptable, to be on TV. And I saw him actually give a pretty damn good, you know, other side of the story, so to speak, on CNN last night. I think it was on CNN last night. And yet, way too polite, if you understand what I mean. Way too conciliatory. Just because of, you know, professionalism and insiderism and all that. So I like, you know, seeing a Boonema on Democracy Now! Going, oh, hell no, let me tell you. You say this, well, I say that, and how do you like that kind of way of debating? Especially on an issue like this where, you know, it's not 60-40 or 70-30. It's 99-1, the relative power of the Israeli state versus the people of Gaza or the Hamas terrorist militia or whatever the hell they are. It's completely out of control. And the same thing for the media bias in their explanation of what all is going on. It's 99-1. The whole thing is completely ridiculous. I'm not certain if it was by Ben Swan, so I ain't pointing fingers or nothing like that. But it was an article at Ben Swan's site anyway that was attempting to be very fair and very objective and very balanced. And the problem was they were analyzing a situation that's not balanced at all. And so, yeah, it's true this about Hamas. It's also true this about Israel, that kind of thing. It's still, just by making it a both sides 50-50 issue, ends up spinning it, you know, two-thirds of the way toward Israel, if you take my meaning. There's, you know, the truth of the situation is that this is not a fair fight at all. This is like a grown man beating up a little kid. This is like the National Guard picking a fight with just, you know, I don't know, the men in your neighborhood who are not prepared. That's a bad analogy. How about the U.S. Army versus your local National Guard? Or versus the people of Fallujah on the weekend? You know? You get it. Anyway. And here's the other thing, too. To be 50-50 and open and honest and all about it, you have to start with the Israelis are occupying Gaza and the West Bank, which are full of refugee populations from what used to be where they lived, where they were chased out of where they lived so that Israel could be Israel in the first place. And now they're occupied. And now somebody kidnapped and killed three guys, and the Prime Minister of Israel decided to make a war out of it for his own interests at their expense. Now that you got the facts laid down, now be honest and tell both sides of the story. The facts aren't, you know, yeah. Balanced. That's what I was trying to say. The facts aren't balanced. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. Darrenscoffee.com. Hey, I'm Scott. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. I had to write a tweet there, man. TheForce.net just retweeted some guy I never heard of. I don't know. Jordan D. White, you ever heard of him? He's got the job being the editor of the new Star Wars movie. So I tweeted him, no effing Gungans. Because, you know, he's the editor. He has the power to edit Gungans out of the movie. And if he reads my tweet, then at least that seed will have been planted, right? That, you know, some people out there might suicide bomb me if I don't edit all the Gungans out of episode 7. Do I really want to mess with them? I mean, I didn't threaten them. I'm not going to suicide bomb anyone. I'm just saying, some people will be really, really mad if there are Gungans in the movie. Okay? That's all I'm saying. Please don't make us hate you, Mr. Editor Man. And I know what you're saying, but the little kids really like the Gungans, Scott. Oh, yeah? Well, when I was a little kid, I really liked Star Wars, and there were no Gungans in it at all. The closest thing to a Gungan was a Tauntaun, and I still liked it. And it was big and ugly and scary, and I was only 3, and it was fine. I didn't need any 9-year-old boys in the movie either. I wanted to be, you know, Luke and or Han, even though they were in their early 20s. I didn't need a 9-year-old boy to be in Star Wars in order to like it, even though I was 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 and on from there. So, no Gungans, no little children in the movies. Please, thank you. It can be Star Wars without Daffy Duck and what you already have C-3PO in the movie. You don't need 2 C-3POs in the movie. Okay? You know what we should do? We should have another C-3PO. No, you should not. You already have the one. And that's good. Okay? Speaking of war crimes, the Israelis continue to butcher tiny children to death, to burn them to death, to blow their tiny little bodies apart with high explosives. Little bitty girls screaming and screaming as they die of blood loss because their arm got blown off. As they die in their mother's arms. You know, that kind of stuff. That's what the Israelis are doing to the people of Gaza. And they're doing it deliberately. They're bombing hospitals. They're bombing refugee camps. They're bombing children on the beach. They're bombing children on their playgrounds. They're bombing children in their schools where they're hiding. And they're doing it as a tactic to make their parents miserable. That's all it is. That's what it is. It's collective punishment. It's based on a strategy of turning the people of Gaza against Hamas, which is, I guess, within the realm of possibility since Hamas really sucks anyway. And yet, 99 times out of 100, maybe more than that, you bomb a country, you make people rally around whatever leadership they're stuck with. Whether it's George W. Bush or whether it's Benjamin Netanyahu or, you know, any other of the lowest scum of the earth, including Hamas. I saw a tweet from somebody who, as best I could tell, is not some, you know, Hamas partisan, but who has been, you know, tweeting about the suffering going on in Gaza over the last couple of weeks, who said, you know, Hamas fights for me. Hamas protects me. It's Israel that's killing me, he said. And I, you know, come on. If you just had to throw a dart at a board, that would be the most likely response that you would get out of the civilians of the Gaza Strip. And they'd be rallying around their security force when threatened, the same as, that's how every state in the world works. You know the famous Goebbels quote, just tell the people they're being threatened by an outside force and that they're not being patriotic if they're descending against the individuals running stuff and how they're running it, and everybody will have to shut up. Works the same in every country, democracies or dictatorships or anything else. But the strategy is, just like when Bill Clinton starved a million Iraqis to death, yeah, a million individual human beings died in Bill Clinton's blockade against Iraq in the 1990s. And the theory was, the hungrier and the more helpless we make the people of Iraq, the more they'll blame Saddam and then they'll rise up and overthrow him. Even though when they had a chance to rise up and overthrow him, George H.W. Bush actually encouraged them to do so and then stabbed them in the back and left them high and dry, left Saddam Hussein with his attack helicopters to mow them all down and his tanks for the Mujahideen-e-Khalq to drive to put down the Kurdish and the Shia uprising back in 1991. And then what? The more starving you make them after that, the more they'll be able to overthrow Saddam? Well, anyway, that's the policy. Same exact thing going on here. It's terrorism. It's the dictionary definition of terrorism. In fact, I looked it up online in the American Heritage Dictionary last night. Violence against civilians in order to cause a reaction or political pressure on their government to cause a change of policies of their government, to either acquiesce to Israel or to be replaced by somebody else. And of course, you could be in sixth grade and ask, well, I wonder who's going to come after Hamas. The Palestinian Authority, the PLO and Fatah and the sock puppets, or somebody worse? But anyway, that's what's going on here. And I know that if you're a decent person, it can be easy to reject that kind of thing. It might be easier, for example, to hear that, oh, Hamas would be doing something like that, deliberately targeting civilians and whatever. Because, you know, they're brown and they speak languages that we can't understand. A lot of Israelis are bilingual, you know. They're whiter, as Saturday Night Live said about George H.W. Bush. Remember that? Vote Bush. He's whiter. Michael Dukakis, why, he's Greek Orthodox. Bush is Episcopalian. Vote Bush. Yeah, same thing here. The Jews are whiter, the Israelis are whiter, and they can speak English more often and more easily and easier to identify with. It just couldn't be that they're deliberately murdering children. Come on. Except that they keep murdering them. And they keep saying, oh no, we use these pinpoint strikes and we do everything we can and we're so very careful. And we give everybody a warning text message that we're about to kill your family. You better run before we kill their family. And somehow, I don't know, it's sort of like the nonsense about Saddam's agents meeting with Mohammed Atta, the lead hijacker of September 11th in Prague. It doesn't matter whether it's true. It's just enough to confuse the issue a little bit, you know? Let's throw some dirt up, confuse things a little bit. But if you look at what's actually happening, they're slaughtering children quite deliberately. They've shrunk the Gaza Strip by 40%, according to the Daily Beast. It's called ethnic cleansing. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples, and email me, scott@scotthorton.org, for more information. See you there. All right, you guys. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. And I'm desperately looking for my link here. Where the hell is it? All right. Well, anyway. I'm Scott Horton. I'm joined on the phone by Danny Mueller. I know I can say he writes for Counterpunch. Oh, here we go. He has worked with Middle East Children's Alliance. That's at MECA for Peace. MECA for Peace.org. And worked also with Voices in the Wilderness there back in the 1990s. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Danny?
Good. Thanks for having me, Scott.
I really appreciate you joining us today. And I got this email alert this morning from the Institute for Public Accuracy, talking about your expertise on the question of water, clean water resources, and related topics in the Gaza Strip. So I appreciate you joining us very much to talk about this here. First of all, can you give us the latest on the state of the infrastructure for water, sewage, electricity in the Gaza Strip?
Sure. Well, the biggest news, unfortunately, this last night in Gaza was that the only power plant that provided electricity for 1.8 million people, 800,000 of those 1.8 million people are children, 14 and under. That power plant was shelled by the Israeli Defense Forces. It was destroyed. It has been attacked in past wars in 2009. So this isn't the first time that Israel has targeted civilian infrastructure, just like the United States, I might say. This adds a very, very urgent level of an urgent layer of need to the humanitarian crisis that was growing before this, but is now in even more of a fragile state. Your listeners would probably know this or be able to piece it together very quickly that you need electricity to provide water. You need electricity to do lots of things, you need electricity to run water pumps, filtration systems, and deliver water to the point of use. So this is not just a lack of lights being on and communication systems down, as horrible as that is. It's an immediate need that most people are having right now for them to be able to get clean and safe drinking water.
All right, now I'm sorry, Danny. I'm sorry, I got to interrupt you for just a second. Say your audio is very inconsistent, and just a second ago it was okay, but you're just all over the place with your audio quality here. So I'm not sure your situation with your microphone there.
I'm really sorry. Can I give you a cell phone to call me at?
Yeah, sure. You got my email there. Could you just email me then?
Very sorry about that. Not sure what's happening, but I'll email you right now.
Okay. Great. And I'll call you right back then.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Sure. Yeah, I'm not sure what's going on there. Well, I guess microphones come in various qualities. Was that just me? That was you guys too, right? There you go. What's this now? I'll have to check that at the break. All right, I'm sorry, guys, to interrupt. I guess I should have just persevered. Let me check my email here again and see if I get that number. I'll try to get him. I won't wait till the break. I'll try to get him back on here in just a sec. Here we go. All right, so here, let me play just a commercial for you real quick. And then we'll be right back with Danny Mueller. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betray their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy. The Off Now project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be
optimistic. All right, y'all. That's offnow.org, of course, there.
All right, good. So I got Danny Mueller back on the line here. Switch from Skype to telephone. Maybe we can do a little better. So I'm sorry. You were saying, Danny, that the Israelis have bombed the power station in Gaza and or the water, too, or just the water's all shut down because the electricity's shut down, you're saying?
Well, I'm saying the water situation has definitely worsened, but before this, you know, this bombardment has been going on for over 3 weeks. But before this, there has been other targeting of sewage stations, wastewater plants, and water pipelines to deliver water throughout the Gaza Strip. So this is a continuation of targeting of civilian infrastructure, which is an international war crime, as well as creating this very real and definitive humanitarian crisis. You have over most recent reports minutes ago from Chris Guinness at the United Nations is that there are over 200,000 people taking shelter at 85 UN official UN shelters. Some of those shelters in the past have been bombed, but just try to imagine trying to get enough clean drinking water to those 200,000 people, let alone the other 1.6 million people who, you know, not in any kind of location or locale that can provide it or safely deliver it. Once you destroy things like water pipelines, you need the ability for maintenance crews to go out and be able to repair those things. And with the status of the intensity of the bombings, there are not ways right now for people to make repairs to the most very basic things we would consider off limits in war, like hospitals and water pipelines.
Man, well, you know, it just seems, I don't know, it seems inconceivable to people that this could be deliberate, even though they say all day long, hey, we use the most precision guided weapons. We take the most care in our targeting. We're the most moral military force ever. We're so careful about what we bomb and how. Do they have excuses for this? There's Hamas fighters shooting rockets from behind the water pipes, or what the hell?
You know, I think it's the scale. To be honest, you know, I think I come at this from the perspective as, you know, I'm an American citizen first. So the reason I'm so critical about this is because it's U.S. weapons that are being used by Israel. And so, you know, and I also, you know, reject this argument of exclusivity because, unfortunately, as many of America's own veterans can tell you, the United States has targeted civilian infrastructure in every war since the World War II. They destroyed over 75% of every standing building in Korea. In Afghanistan, after September 11th, they ran out of targets within 24 hours. They were in Iraq in both 1991 and 2003. They directly targeted the civilian infrastructure, and that was water and electric plants. So this is the way that the West fights war. It's the way that have this effect on civilian populations, and then we wonder why people come back at us with anti-American attitudes. It's very, very, unfortunately, very easy, even without electricity. You go on your smartphone in Gaza right now and go pick up a piece of shrapnel from an Israeli bombing and find a piece that has a tracking number on it, and you can type that into your phone, and you can see that it was made in the United States. You can see when and where it was made. So it doesn't take a lot of skill and savvy for people to put together that the United States is not an honest broker in this arrangement. And we haven't been for a while. We send over $3 billion in economic and military aid to Israel every year. And, you know, there's people in Detroit with their water being shut off, and we're not sending $3 billion there. So there's very much a need, I think, for people who are concerned about what's happening for whatever reason, to take this to their own representatives.
All right, I'm sorry. Hold it right there, Danny. We got to take this break. We'll be right back, y'all, with Danny Mueller on the situation in the Gaza Strip. Hey, y'all. Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. We're talking about Benjamin Netanyahu's canned hunt, slaughtering children for fun and for land in Gaza. The Daily Beast is reporting that Gaza's already shrunk by 40%. How do you like that? That buffer zone just keeps getting bigger and bigger. They're ethnically cleansing the Gaza Strip. I'm on the line right now with Danny Mueller. He's worked with the Middle East Children's Alliance and written for Counterpunch. And we're talking about the war on their infrastructure, their sewage, their water, their electricity, the war against the men, women, and children of the Gaza Strip, the Gaza Strip prison. And I wanted to tell you, Danny, that later on in the show, I'm going to be talking with Ken Klippenstein about this great piece he did, really detailing the amount of American financial and military support for Israel. And we really got that covered today, even. Mm-hmm. I want to try to get you back to the situation on the ground in the Gaza Strip as somebody who's been there, who's worked with these people, who's seen the aftermath of previous wars there. And, you know, paint a picture my audience can see in their mind about what is really going on over there and what it's like, especially for the children of the Gaza Strip, who are, of course, almost half the population, right about half the population of Gaza is under the age of 18. So just
incredibly young, crowded place. And the destruction that's happened during these last 3 weeks, from all reports from people that I'm talking to, by Facebook and by email and phone every day, it's way worse than it was in 2009, 2012, when I was there after both of those wars. I'm reticent even to call them wars because, it's not that Hamas has Gaza doesn't have a standing army, doesn't have a navy, doesn't have an air force. It's this incredibly unbalanced onslaught with one of the most sophisticated militaries in the world against people firing rocket launchers. You know, I mean, it's not even comparable. So the level of destruction, I can only say, from being in places like Iraq and Gaza that, I'm there in the aftermath. I'm not there as it's going on. So I can only imagine or try to imagine what it's like for families and children who are hunched away from windows because they know that at any moment those can blow out, hidden in the back room of an apartment, you know, trying to scavenge for supplies and keep their own day-to-day needs taken care of. You know, you're talking about really basic things like getting water or chronic medications, you know, become immediately unavailable for chronic disease. And the level of fear that these children have to go through, these effects, you know, when the ceasefire ends, if a ceasefire begins, the trauma that children feel and the entire population feel goes on for generations. I mean, it's children who witness this incredible level of violence. If they lose a loved one, if they see someone injured or blown apart next to them, the types of symptoms that you see in the population are just, there's no other word for it. They're heartbreaking. Children start to lose control of their bladders. They don't sleep. They have night terrors. They don't make eye contact. They refuse to, speak or look at you or eat, mental health professionals will do what they can, but you're talking hundreds and hundreds of thousands of children now at this point who for 23 days have not had any sense of safety or security and are faced with very serious public health, you know, needs and a growing crisis. If you are a seven-year-old in Gaza today, this would be your third war that you are going through. You can talk to people here, and I can tell you about what that does to your brain development of a seven-year-old when you are that stressed for that period, long a period of time. That affects how your brain develops for your life. And so we are paying attention to Gaza now because what's happening is horrendous, but we have to think about the long-term impacts of war. This is not going to go away if a ceasefire begins tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, it's just a nightmare. You know, I guess it's a problem of mine now, Danny, that I'm just glued to Twitter. And I just, all day long, the pictures of the dead kids and the screaming ones and the pile of rubble left without any of their family anymore and this kind of thing. I mean, it's very real to this suburban Austinite, what it's like for those people over there, as close as I can be to it anyway. And it is an absolute nightmare, and it's just no question, like you were referring to before, There's no mystery why terrorist groups, individuals join terrorist groups so that they can take out their rage over this kind of thing against the United States because of the degree to which we're in on it. And that's why it's so important. You know, there are a lot of different wars all over the world. Well, there's not really that many, but, you know, you're right the way you focus on, because you're an American, because our government is responsible for this to such a great degree. That's why it's so important that we focus on it. And so,
yeah, and I mean, just to put someone there, you know, you can see these massive explosions, and to think, like, when I've been in any kind of situation like this, you know, you can't see, you're surrounded, and it's not just dust, you know, these are heavy metals in the air. There, yeah. It's the type of air you just can't breathe. I've been, you know, you're retching on, you know, you can't even think straight. You can be blinded by the blast of these explosions. There are sonic waves that can give brain injuries. I mean, the sheer level of intensity means that people are operating on adrenaline and little else. And so, there, you know, these pictures tell part of it, and you know, we, as we said, we're both sitting in safe environments here. Yeah. But you know, what's happening nonstop? I mean, you're talking about leveling, you know, city blocks in one of the most densely populated places on the planet. Yeah. So I think there really is a sea change. I think people, because so many people are getting their news now from the internet, they are paying attention to what's happening in a different way. And I would say in the United States, there seems to be very much a sea change of people being shocked about what's happening, right, because they're seeing these pictures. And, you know, there isn't really an argument that holds up where someone tries to justify bombing a hospital, right? Like, there has to be a baseline of agreement in a civilized society of where we can begin a conversation. And I think most rational people now are at the point where, okay, bombing a hospital is off limits. Bombing, yeah, electrical and water treatment plants are off limits. So if that's off limits, if that's wrong, then there needs to be legitimate criticism of Israel, which is doing that.
Yeah. Well, now, and back to the terror. I mean, obviously, people, young children bleeding to death and everything is that. But back to the terror and the shell shock, basically, that the children are suffering there. You know, maybe a good analogy would be September 11th. It's long enough ago now, and it was exploited so cynically that people kind of, I think, you know, they rebel against their former emotions connected to that thing. But people remember back. I mean, the entire giant, very safe United States had mental health problems, mental health trauma, yep, all over the place, right? Numbers of people seeking professional counseling and that kind of thing just went absolutely through the roof over one very big attack in the U.S. back in 2001. But that really traumatized the hell out of the entire nation. Well, just think about, you know, that kind of thing, only it just keeps going on and on. They level Brooklyn, and then they level Philadelphia, right? They, you know, whatever, yeah, take down major buildings and downtowns all over America, and it goes on for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks in your town, too. I mean, man, that's what these people are going through there. September 11th is happening to them on an hourly basis, on a quarterly hourly basis.
And it's not just a destruction of homes. It's a destruction of memories. You know, you think, because I'm from New York City, actually. So September 11th is, you know, I actually lost friends and family on September 11th in New York. And so, you know, it still affects me, and it was still horrendous. And the World Trade Center was a place that I had these childhood memories going as a kid. It was part of my life. You know, it was part of my neighborhood that didn't exist anymore. So now what doesn't exist in Gaza? There are playgrounds and hospitals and schools and mosques and places that don't exist, where people have spent their lives, where they've gotten married, where they've had funerals, where they've given birth, and these places are being wiped off the map. So there's this collective trauma, and we need to take some responsibility for it. The need is just incredibly overwhelming, as one can imagine. But I can say at least there is something people can do. The organization I work with, the Middle East Children's Alliance, is focusing on getting immediate short-term emergency aid for people in need, and long-term study been doing for over 5 years called Let the Children Play and Heal. We provide psychosocial support for children who've been traumatized by war. So people who are interested in supporting this work and being involved in this work or learning more about it can go to mecaforpeace.org, mecaforpeace.org. They can also search us on the web or find out more ways that they can support these incredibly important, urgently needed projects.
Yeah, thank you so much for saying that. I'm sorry, I meant to give you more time to discuss contact information and how people can help out with these projects. So again, that's Mecca with one C, M-E-C-A, mecaforpeace.org. Thank you very much for your time, Danny. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
We'll be right back, y'all. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And next up is our friend Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst, now peacenik. He's co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and he writes most often for consortiumnews.com. And very soon you'll be able to find this on the blog over at antiwar.com. It is the newest memo for the president from the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Welcome back to the show, Ray. How are you doing?
Thank you, Scott. Doing well.
Good, good. Very happy to have you here. So now, a lot of this we've gone over, because I've been interviewing you a lot about Ukraine over the past couple of weeks here, and now you've got it all in memo to the president form. I'll let you go back over as much of the argument as you feel is necessary here. But the bottom line here is you're warning the president that the Secretary of State's talking points are way out ahead of the information here. And I guess most importantly, you're saying that you're hearing from people inside the U.S. intelligence community that that is the case. Can you please elaborate?
That's right, Scott. You know, it's very, very unsettling to see John Kerry and others run off and all but indict and convict the Russians for supplying so-called separatists down in eastern Ukraine with the missile that shot down that Malaysian aircraft flight number 17. The evidence that has been deduced, well, let me put it this way. The Pope or the Dalai Lama would have real trouble gaining credibility for the case that's been made by these fuzzy photos by twittering from our U.S. ambassador in Kiev, and by social media sort of things. I mean, the whole thing is embarrassing to a professional intelligence officer, and that's what we tell the president. You know, if you don't have any better than this, any evidence better than this, more conclusive of any kind, if you're unwilling to ask your $75 billion operation called U.S. intelligence to serve up after 12 days a coordinated interagency assessment of what the evidence is, then, we don't say it this way, but he ought to put up or shut up, and that goes for Kerry especially.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, so what about this, though? I mean, it could be interpreted, I guess, let me pretend I'm CNN here for a second. The burden is on you with your wacky, extraordinary claims here. Everybody knows that the most likely thing here is that the rebels did it accidentally, thinking they were shooting at a Kiev coup government military plane, and they killed all these people, and now they're trying to get away with it. And so what's your alternative narrative then, Mr. Former Intelligence Professional?
Well, Wolf Blitzer, let me comment on that. Everybody knows. That may be true, but that's only because everybody listens to Wolf Blitzer and others, CNN, and regretfully, some of my former colleagues who are getting paid big bucks to be, quote, experts on this. it's very, very unsettling. So what we have here is a situation where if the United States knows that the so-called separatists, I call them federalists, you know, I'm a separatist. I mean, we were all separatists when we were ruled by dictators, not in Kiev, but in London. So these separatists, you know, if they got these weapons, well, where's the beef? Where's the meat? Why can't you show something conclusive? Now, they're not even hiding behind sources and methods. They're not saying we have something tangible, but we can't tell you because that would blow our source. No, they're just showing fuzzy photographs and repeating this line, giving it to the David Gregorys of this world and the Wolf Blitzers. And that's why, Wolf, everybody thinks that it's a done deal. It's a flat fact that, sure, the Russians are responsible because they gave these missiles to the Ukrainians. We have no photos. We have no imagery. Does Washington know what happened? Yes. Washington knows what happened. Does Washington have evidence about what happened? Yes. Washington has that evidence. There's no way you can persuade me that after 12 days of this, our intelligence assets, including overhead satellites and everything else, weren't lined up to discover what happened then and since. So if we don't have anything better to serve up than Twitters from the U.S. ambassador in Kiev and fuzzy photographs given out to the Washington Post and others last week here in Washington, well, you know, if I were anti-American, I might suspect that they ain't got no conclusive evidence. Or they know that it was the Ukrainians who shut that plane down. I still think probably by mistake, but the Ukrainians, of course, have these missiles. We know that. We also know that, at least according to the Russians, the Ukrainians had a big radar trained on that flight. And we know that they had some Buk, they had some of these SA-11 missile emplacements within range of the aircraft, according to the Russians. Now, you have to take that with a grain of salt, too, but at least the Russians have provided some tangible evidence. We have not. And that's what we're appealing to the president. We're saying, look, Mr. President, the nine of us signed this memo have a cumulative total of 260 years in intelligence-related fields, various parts of the intelligence community. We've been there, done that. We've seen instances like this in the past. The KAL-0071 is the direct parallel. That happened in 1983. Obama was 21. I don't know how closely he followed that or how closely he's been briefed.
Ray, I'm sorry, but just because we're short on time, and we did talk about that one before in the last interview.
Did we? Okay.
If we could get back to the specifics on this one here about what you were just saying about how the Russians have showed satellite pictures and said, here, the Ukrainian government has these missiles. And the Americans, if I heard it right, if I remember right, they have said that they have satellite pictures of missiles in the hands of the rebels. They just haven't shown it to anybody. Is that right?
I don't know that they have, in an official way, said that they have that kind of evidence. If they do, my point is, if they do, they should release it. Mm-hmm. And if they don't have it, then that would suggest to me the explanation as to why they don't release it.
Yeah.
You can't release it if you don't have it.
Well, and wouldn't they, if they did have it, they would absolutely use it to contradict the Russians. If the Russians are pulling an Adlai Stevenson and breaking out their satellite pictures, then the Americans have to trump that if they have a card to play, right? They can't just let that slide unless they have to.
Unless they don't have it.
Yeah.
See, that's the suspicion. You know, in the past, we had used in this memo the example of when the Libyans bombed that discotheque in Berlin, mm-hmm, back in 88, I think it was. We had the goods on them. We had intercepted messages. They bragged about it, okay? Ronald Reagan creamed Gaddafi's complex, killed one of his little daughters, okay? Now, the world was in high dudgeon. It's saying, what? How can that happen? How do you know there was a Libyans? And Reagan came to us and he said, we got to release that intercepted message. And we said, no, you can't. Sources are meth. No, you'll blow our source. The Libyans don't know, A, that we're intercepting their communications, and B, that we can decipher it, okay? Right. So we can't do that. And Reagan says, do it. And we did it, and we blew the source, but the whole world was able to see. Now I hasten to add, I don't justify killing little children, but the whole world was able to see that at least Ronald Reagan was not lying when he said we had the goods
on
who did this, who bombed this discotheque in Berlin.
All right, and now, I'm sorry, can you tell me in 45 seconds or 30 maybe, real quick, how it would be, like under what theory? Well, I guess we'll have to wait. When we get back from this break, I'm going to ask Ray McGovern about the theory. If Kiev did it accidentally, you know, what's the missing piece there? Because if the rebels did it, then you could see how maybe they thought they were defending themselves from a Kievian jet, right? From a Western Ukrainian government jet. But if the Kiev government did it, who did they think they were shooting at? Who, you know, was who they were directing, who they knew was a civilian flight and was flying from west to east and all the rest of this. Anyway, but that's on the other side of this break with Ray McGovern, veteran intelligence professional for Sanity, which, of course, is asking a lot, but we're trying here. One sec. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Talking with Ray McGovern. Where can we read the memo, asks M. Strong in the chat room. It will be on the anti-war blog very soon, I think, because I sent it, I emailed it to Eric, and then I sent him an instant message saying I had emailed it to him. So, sorry. That is actually not good enough to make it happen yet, but very soon, I promise, at antiwar.com/blog, and then I'm sure, what, Ray, it'll go up at Consortium News and where else? Do you know for sure?
It'll be on consortiumnews.com, and then, of course, antiwar.com. Be on my website, which is raymcgovern.com.
Great.
So it'll be around as soon as we get
it.
Yeah,
Common Dreams will probably run it, right?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, good deal. So, yeah, Ray McGovern, for 27 years, he was a CIA analyst. Now he's a peacenik and tried to truth us out of the last few wars to no avail. Well, actually, I don't know. He might have helped truth us out of the Iran war a couple of times there, Ray. I appreciate that.
And Syria.
As opposed to lying us into war, which seems to be the CIA's usual task. And it seems like, actually, speaking of Iraq and all that last few wars, the CIA, and they were a lot of individuals there, and as an institution, they really did help the neocons and the administration lie us into war with Iraq, but they took all the blame for it, and that really pissed a lot of them off. And they've been pushing back against Iran propaganda, Syria propaganda, now Iran propaganda, Ukraine propaganda ever since. Isn't that about right?
Some are, yeah. I don't feel any sympathy for those of my colleagues on the analysis end of things, will let themselves be suborned into manufacturing evidence to deceive our Congress people out of their constitutional prerogative to declare or otherwise authorize war. That was the worst of it. Since then, that was Iraq, of course. Since then, some honest analysts have performed admirably on Iran in deciding back in 2007 that Iran stopped working on a nuclear weapon in 2003. That helped to prevent a war in Iran. And then on Syria, late last August, as you'll recall, Obama had his guided missile destroyers, four of them, right off, right in the eastern Mediterranean, ready to strike Syria, when finally General Dempsey, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, jumped in together with some of my former colleagues who said, look, we're not going to do Iraq number two. We don't have the evidence. What you're hearing from John Kerry is not true. He doesn't know that it was the Bashar al-Assad government that perpetrated the chemical attacks. And indeed, largely because of folks like you and other people who stirred up the Congress people and the people who were Congress people were at home, you know, it was August, so people got to them. The British even voted against war with Syria, and finally Obama relented, and he said, all right, General Dempsey, what do you suggest? And Dempsey said, well, two things. Number one, we have samples of that sarin gas, and it's not the same as is in Syrian government stockpiles. You might mention that. And number two, we think that when push comes to shove, you could just say, look, we're ready to destroy Syria. You want to say destroy? We're ready to strike Syria, but we don't have to do it today. We can do it tomorrow or next week or next month. And that indeed is what the president said in the Rose Garden on the 31st of August, less than 24 hours after John Kerry had pleaded for war on Syria, saying 35 times, I counted them, we know Bashar al-Assad perpetrated those chemical attacks. In the event, I mean, after looking at all the evidence, including from the British and, of course, Cy Hirsch, I know with 90% certainty that it was the rebels, whom we knew had sarin and who had every bit of incentive to trip the red line wire that Obama had been foolishly encouraged to set, so that the U.S. would come in with its military overtly and stem the losses. Assad was winning. This time last year, he was driving the rebels out of this or that stronghold.
All right, quick.
Something had happened.
Clock's ticking, Ray. We got to get back to Ukraine.
Yeah.
I know. There's so many damn wars they try to lie us into. I shouldn't have got us off track at first. Let me ask you this.
Right.
It makes sense, just guessing, that, okay, the rebels thought they were being threatened by Ukrainian attack jet. They had, magically, somehow, they had this missile nobody can find that they shot it down with, whatever. At least you could see the how they could have made that mistake. But under what circumstances does it make sense that the Ukrainians mistakenly targeted this civilian plane and shot it down? I don't get it.
Well, Scott, the Ukrainian armed forces are not known for their discipline, nor their sobriety, nor their professionalism. It's altogether possible that this was mistakenly a shot from the kind of weaponry that we know Ukraine has. Okay, we don't know. I don't care what Kerry says. There's no evidence that I believe that those missiles were given to the separatists out there in the eastern Ukraine. If, you know, if there's a chance, I'm willing to say, okay, hypothetically, if Russia gave them those missiles, you can be sure, Scott, that at least 30 military advisors went with each one of those missiles to make sure, to make ironclad sure that this would not happen, okay? So,
who has
the missiles? The Ukrainians have the missiles. Right. What are we told by our former colleagues? Well, indirectly, we've learned that there is satellite photography of a Buk, a SS-11 missile battery in the Ukraine within range of the plane that was going over. And we're told that the satellite photography not only shows distinctive Ukrainian uniforms, but also a bunch of beer bottles strewn all over the campsite. There were the campsites strewn all over the missile base. Okay, now that's not definitive, but as if the Russians are right, and I see the Russians as letting Obama and Kerry have more and more rope. The Russians have already given some evidence to the international inspection team. And if they're right, if they can prove that radar was turned on, the Ukrainian radar, and that there were Ukrainian batteries within range, well, I would think most likely it was a mistake. But I lean toward the interpretation that it was the Ukrainians that did it, that the U.S. knows that full well. And that's why the U.S. is prevaricating, charging the Russians with this heinous deed, knowing that it was their puppets in Kiev mm-hmm. that were really responsible. It all makes sense to me if that's the interpretation.
Right. Okay, now, I'm sorry, we're almost out of time for this segment, but I'm going to keep recording you into the commercial break here for just a moment, because I want to ask you two things real quick. The first one is, I got an email from a guy asking, and it sounds silly, but it's a good question. Is there some reason that the American government would have to believe that the Russian nuclear arsenal is somehow no longer a threat? Are they, I mean, not that they would necessarily be right, Ray, But do they think that now they have first strike capability, they're not worried about it, the Russians are pushovers, and we're just going to turn them into our little bitches, and that's the end of that? Or is anyone in D.C. at the Council on Foreign Relations or inside the State Department or the National Security Council pointing out that these guys got thousands of H-bombs, and we can actually only push them so far without us getting into real trouble here? What the hell? Because this policy really does seem to be based from the premise of, well, we're not really worried about that anymore, right?
Well, Kerry has said precisely that. They said, aren't you a little concerned about escalation of armed hostilities with Russia? He said, oh, no, we've taken that into account. Now, put yourself in Putin's position. He's the Secretary of State, dismissively, kind of nonchalantly say, oh, yeah, we'll take that into account. Well, the answer to your question is no. There's nobody sensible that believes that the Russian nuclear deterrent is inoperable. But there are a lot of crazies out there, Scott, as we know. And what the tactic now, led by Bobby Gates, actually, when he was Secretary of Defense, see, the Poles and the Czech Republic, they didn't much care for being on the targeting end of these anti-ballistic missile systems,
right,
which are actually aimed at securing a first-strike capability. And Putin has said that. And Bobby Gates says, yeah, the Russians are afraid of that. But you know what? I don't really worry about the Russians too much, okay? So that's the attitude. Now, if Ukraine went to NATO, if U.S. Ships upon which these missiles are now based because of innovations by Gates, he wanted to prevent the Czechs or the Poles from turning around and saying, no, no, you can't have them here. So that's why, and Putin has said it's precisely this threat, even more than nominal membership in NATO. It's the threat that Sevastopol in Crimea, their main naval, their only warm water port, would become a NATO port. That these missile defense, so-called assistance, would be put there. And Putin himself has, don't be deceived. We know these are offensive missiles. We know that they're targeted on our ICBMs to give the U.S. a first strike capability. That is incredibly, incredibly dangerous, because then it's launch on warning, and we haven't been back there for about 35 years.
Yeah. All right, well, I'm sorry we're out of time. We got to go, but thank you so much for your time again, Ray. Appreciate it.
Most welcome, Scott. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, you too. That's the great Ray McGovern, everybody. He's at raymcgovern.com, at consortiumnews.com. At antiwar.com. He's got an archive, and the latest Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity memo will be on the Antiwar blog here any moment now. We'll be right back. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement, featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more. The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty, and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. Well, god dang it, Bobby. I kept Ray over extra time there, and then only late did I realize I don't have contact info for my next guest. I have a, yes, let's do 12:30 Eastern time, but I don't have a phone number or Skype contact yet. So, I should have just kept interviewing Ray, god dang it. There's so much more I could have asked him. What the hell's going on right now? You know, on CNN this morning, Barbara Starr, and this is as much about the media as it is about the war in Ukraine. Barbara Starr is reporting, and she's getting this from the Pentagon. Of course, she might as well work for the Pentagon. She's their spokesman, posing as a CNN reporter kind of person, you know. Never a critical question asked, just mind a bird. And what she says is that the Kiev government, the coup government, the American-backed government is launching, I'm not sure if she called them strategic or tactical, I don't know what that has to do with it anyway, mid-range ballistic missiles, not nukes, but mid-range ballistic missiles with 1,000-pound warheads on them at Donetsk. And she was saying this like, whoa, that's problematic because, of course, they must be blasting innocent people to pieces with those things. Well, is that the Pentagon getting too far out in front of the State Department there on opposing this thing? If they put her out with talking points like that, that this is a problematic problem, CNN audience. That the government in Kiev, man, they're launching a major attack against Donetsk right now. Many civilians have been killed. I saw a couple of headlines about dozens of people being killed in the east. They have a license to get away with all this. Man, I should call Ray back. You know what? Listen to this. Hey, Al Scott here. Oh, ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time?
That's right, he's
well, a friend
Scott.
Of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan
all
the
right.
back
of so, Ray, I'm yeah. sorry. You know what? My next guest, I don't have the correct contact info for her anyway, and so can I still interview you for a few more minutes here?
Yeah, sure.
Thank you so much.
No problem.
This will make for a fun edit for Adam later. Hey, listen.
Okay.
So what I wanted to ask you about is there's a major offensive going on now in the east by the Kiev government, and yet John Kerry was on TV. Did you see him this morning on CNN talking about a ceasefire? I'm wondering if maybe they're concerned that they gave Kiev too long of a leash. Barbara Starr was reporting that they're launching ballistic missiles with 1,000-pound warheads at Donetsk, and that apparently the Pentagon was pretty concerned about this. And I just wonder what you think about what's happening today.
Well, Scott, this is a really good question because unnoticed by the press was the president's speech where he talked about an outrage of unspeakable proportions. Okay. And he leaned toward the interpretation that the Russians were responsible. He also said, for the first time in weeks, that a ceasefire would be a good idea, that we should have an immediate ceasefire. Now, that was the 17th, so that's 12 days ago. Why is that significant? Well, because for the previous 10 days, even though the head of Germany, the head of France, so Merkel and Hollande, and Putin himself, together, had called several times for an immediate ceasefire. And the U.S. said, no, Ukraine has the right to defend itself, just, I might add, parenthetically, as the Israelis have, quote, the right to defend themselves, end quote. Mm-hmm. And so, the only supporter of any moment of the Ukraine going ahead with not renewing the ceasefire and starting a major offensive in the east was the United States of America. So it's significant that on the 17th, the president said, yeah, immediate ceasefire. Now, I'm afraid that the president having said that and his puppet having completely disregarded it, that, how shall I say this, that the president of the United States appears rather hypocritical, would you say? Because everyone knows that Poroshenko wouldn't brush his teeth without asking Obama or Kerry first. So, in answer to your question, the Ukrainians are just hell-bent on doing away with the resistance in the east. The U.S. is rhetorically in favor of a ceasefire. Kerry said it again today. But until they put the reins on Poroshenko, the carnage is going to keep going there, and the refugees will be all pouring across the Russian border.
Right, and then what?
Well, Putin, in my view, and I've had some experience with Russian leaders, you know, he knows what the game is. He's, I'm afraid, not only clever, but he looks into the future, and he does not want to be provoked into invading Ukraine. There are lots of ways that he could support those in the Ukraine that need his support. And it looks like, you know, sort of a face-off there. I'm not sure the rebels are being extinguished as the Ukrainians say they're going to do. And so this thing will be a low-intensity conflict for a while unless unless some of these photos and some of these other reports find their way into the Western press, and the Western press says, well, you know, what really is going on here? Are the Ukrainian authorities from Kiev really trying to put down something that can't be put down? And why, after all, is it impossible to talk about a federal solution to this and a neutrality of the kind that Finland has? Take away those plans to have the Ukraine join NATO. Make sure that there's a ceasefire and then some talks. That's the way grown people act. Adults get together around a conference table, whether it's in Geneva or Paris or wherever, and they talk the thing out. And the stakeholders need to do precisely that, because these things can be settled. But not if the real design is to sort of envelop Ukraine into the model that the IMF would like to see, and if there actually are still designs to incorporate Ukraine together with Crimea and everything else into NATO. That is such a red line for Russia, I have to say, that there would be war if we really tried to do that.
What's funny is, if you wanted to be a kook about it, you could say it's Russian agents in the American government who are setting all this up to go ahead and give at least eastern Ukraine back to Russia. Because that seems to be the most likely outcome of this crisis on the path that they're going down right now. America's not going to get Ukraine. Russia's going to get it back is what's going to happen here. Is at least, that's as you're saying, that's what they're trying to bait Russia into doing. But well, how does that make any sense if what they're trying to do is expand NATO?
Yeah, the Russians don't want to bite off that piece of land. You know, it resembles Iraq in some respects. Most sane people said, okay, it's an artificial creation by the British and French way back, you know, 100 years ago or so. But, yeah, let's keep it all together. Let's have a government in Baghdad, in this case, that would be receptive to sharing power with others. Well, it didn't work. And now it looks like that sort of thing is devolving into Kurdistan, and the Shia and the Sunnis would have their own separate kinds of thing. Now, the oil makes it crucial there with respect to Iraq. So similarly, with respect to Ukraine, I don't know any sane people that think it's a good idea to break it in two. Now, that may eventuate. It may come to that. But we have the power to prevent Poroshenko from going off half-cocked. And right now we've been reluctant to use that power, even though we piously call for a ceasefire. Where is the ceasefire? It's far from a ceasefire out that way, and we could prevent that from happening. So if Kerry is serious about this, all he has to do is call up Poroshenko and say, all right, lay off. We're going to go to talks. We're going to talk this thing through.
Yep.
And he hasn't done it, and he won't do it, and I don't trust him.
All right. Thank you very much, Ray. I sure appreciate it.
You're most welcome.
All right, y'all. That's the great Ray McGovern. We'll be right back. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, y'all, one thing that didn't come up in that conversation with Ray is Pat Buchanan's new article at antiwar.com today, where he talks about these new sanctions in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Right now, the Republicans are the minority, and the Democrats aren't going along with this for the moment. Thank goodness. But if the Republicans win the majority in the Senate, it's the guy who would be chair is the guy pushing these new sanctions that would be, you know, very harsh sanctions on, you know, whatever Russian financial interests, I don't know the specifics, but bad enough to pick a real fight if the Russians don't capitulate completely. Not only do they have to, you know, make the rebels stop trying to secede from the Union over there, and really Ray is technically right that they are Federalists. They're not even saying they want complete independence. The Russians are not, you know, absorbing them the way they have Crimea. And so they're left with Kiev. The only question is on what terms, you know? Basically, they're going to be autonomous, not independent. That's, you know, how it is right now. But anyway, these sanctions even say that the Russians have to give up Crimea. That's been their port since the days of the Articles of Confederation. After the American Revolution, but before the Constitution. In the 1880s, that's when the Russians first colonized Crimea and made it their warm water port, their last warm water port. Without the USSR, that's what the Russians are left with. I don't know what were their other warm water ports when they were the USSR, but they had some. But anyway, they're not giving Crimea back. This is a declaration of at least Cold War. And another thing that we didn't have time to get to here is about the rearmament of NATO and all this. You know, there ain't no kookery about it. I mean, this is the military, industrial, congressional, banking complex of financial transfers from you and me to the state. That is a large part of what's going on here. An excuse to get rid of some crappy F-22s and F-35s and whatever nonsense that they can give to the Europeans on the American taxpayers' dollars, they'll do it. And if you were a banker, wouldn't you like to service the transaction between the U.S. Treasury and Lockheed for their purchases of all these new products? There's a whole new generation of weapon sales and training. I almost think that, I guess I'm remembering back to my study of the last Cold War, that it seemed like part of it was at least implicit that, like, hey, you Soviets know that we're only pretending to be this scared of you so that we can justify a bunch of weapon sales to the American people, right? So don't worry, we're not really going to attack you. We're just stealing from them and you're the excuse. Get it? Wink, wink, nudge, nudge kind of thing. And so I'm kind of transferring that onto the current situation. I sure hope that Putin is smart enough, him and his little cabinet sitting around, that someone is bringing up that, of course, you know, this is all just a scam. They don't really want a nuclear war, boss. They just, you know, they want to sell the fighter bombers that could, in fact, deliver weapons. But anyway, you know, so maybe we could avoid war that way. Oh, they're just, it's all a big scam. Don't worry about it. After all, Robert Gates said, we don't need a bunch of F-22s. We need a bunch of F-35s. Because F-22s are only good for fighting powers that actually have air forces. Whereas F-35s, you can kill people on the ground better, and we're mostly fighting against helpless peasants in their own countries that we're occupying and warring against them for daring to resist us, and so we need our fighters to be at least fighter bombers so that, you know, we can equip them with two bombs per sortie. Oh, it's got to be stealthy, right? Like the F-35 is stealthy. Anyway, two bombs and at least they can target things on the ground. There's a whole other market of fighter planes for dealing with countries that actually have air forces, you know, like Russia and China. So there's a whole, yeah, anyway. Maybe that could help prevent war. If someone would just let the Russians know that we don't really want to have a war with you, we just need an excuse for some of the most corrupt parts of our economy to get away with reaching their hand into the treasury, like the lousy welfare whores that they are. So, don't worry, you're just the excuse, but we don't really mean you any harm, you know. And let them know that, so they don't overreact. Yes, and we want your natural gas and your oil and your wheat. But that can wait. We'll wait till Putin dies of old age, right? Because if you overthrow Putin, or if you really try to overthrow Putin, that's going to lead to a real war, don't you think? And you know what? Same question as in Syria, same question as in Palestine, same question as in Iraq. Yeah, you get rid of this guy, and then what? You know? Who do you think is waiting in the wings to take over from Putin? The most loyal American sock puppet? I sort of doubt that. I would think it would be someone further to the right than him. Wouldn't you? And I don't know how in the hell they think they're going to be able to overthrow the Kremlin anyway, short of dropping an H-bomb on it. Pretty sure Putin can handle, you know, our color revolutions in Moscow. And I'm sure he would go to any length to do so if it came down to it, too. All right, well. So, now I'm hearing back from my guest that I screwed up the timing with. But now she wants the time that I've already given to somebody else. So now who should I ask? Should I bump my previous guest? Or should I try to put her off for half an hour on the wrist that she probably also can't? I guess I should not bump my previous guest. That would be more rude. But then again, I already was rude to this lady once by my failure to follow up and firm up the interview. Whereas the other guy, I would, you know, then be rude to him just the one time. Etiquette and protocol. I need a droid because I'm not good at it myself. You know, I need instructions. All right. Coming up, guests. Coming up, Ken Klippenstein and or I sure hope Nora Erekat. I'm gonna try to work that out here in just a couple of minutes now. But you know what? Let me bring up this for you. Well, man, I want to talk about Iraq stuff. I don't really have time to talk about Iraq stuff. Let me bring this up in context to Gaza. We've talked about this for years on the show. You may already be familiar, but there's a great new article written about it. This is someone else I'm trying to get on the show, actually. It's a great article at Salon.com. I know, they're completely retarded now, but this is a good article. It's by Deepa Kumar. It's called The More the Dead, the Better. Israel's Crumbling Media War. That's an assertion from Netanyahu that, the Palestinians just love dying. They love getting their children killed for the PR mileage they get out of it or whatever nonsense. And this article is about how no one believes that because you're an evil, stupid liar and you're ridiculously stupid if you think that we believe that. And then the article goes on to remind us of this. The author of the article reminds us of the Israel Project's 2009 Global Language Dictionary. Patrick Coburn also has a write-up on this in The Independent. At independent.co.uk as well. The Israel Project's 2009 Global Language Dictionary. And it's amazing. I mean, you know, this is like a report from Iron Mountain kind of thing where if it was satire, you could totally see how, man, that's some good satire. I see what you're doing there kind of thing. No, this is real. This is Frank Luntz, the pollster, advising Israelis and the American Israel lobby how to lie to and manipulate Americans into believing the things that the Israelis would have them believe. And the purpose, of course, is to get you to believe things that aren't true. That way you'll support Israel. Because if you understand the truth of their policy and what they're doing to their captives in the Gaza Strip and in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, in the occupied territories there, and what they have been doing to them for almost half a century now, then you won't be on the side of the Israeli government at all. They have to lie to you to get you to side with them. And if you read this thing, even if you hate my guts, and this is the first time you heard this, and you're such a Democrat or Republican or whatever your problem is, you don't know what the hell you're hearing here, and you just don't like me, go read this thing. This is advice from Frank Luntz, the world-famous pollster and TV pundit, usually on Fox News, but not exclusively. And this is his advice to the Israelis of how to lie to and manipulate Americans, how to turn every truth about the situation over there upside down for the consumption of the American mind. And it's a riot. I mean, it's really a lot of fun in that, holy crap, this is the world I live in kind of a way. Read all about it at Salon.com. The more the dead, the better. Israel's crumbling media war. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org. LibertyRadioNetwork.com. All right. You may have seen this article. It went viral around the internet over the weekend. Anyway, we ran as the spotlight on antiwar.com. 5 Israeli talking points on Gaza debunked. And this is no, you know, BuzzFeed, you know, hack job. This is a, you know, because the 5, the list, don't be turned off by the list. That's what I'm trying to say here. This is really great stuff here, and I hope you've already taken a look at it. The author is Nora Erekat, and she is a human rights attorney and activist, Abraham L. Friedman Fellow at Temple University Beasley School of Law, and a contributing editor of Jadalia, I think, something like that. And this is at thenation.com. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Great, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Sure thing. I sure appreciate you joining us today. And so this is a very important article, as I was trying to get across there, however clumsily. I really do hope people look at it. Again, 5 Israeli talking points on Gaza debunked and thoroughly, I might add. And if it's okay with you, Nora, I'd like to start with number 5, because this is the one that I think is, well, it's as important as any of the others, but it's the one that is the least addressed of all of them, I think. And you do a very good job of handling the question, the accusation, that Hamas hides all their weapons in homes full of civilians. They use the people of the Gaza Strip as human shields. And they kind of leave this out. It's kind of silent but included. And so, therefore, it's okay to kill the civilians because, you know, hey, what are we supposed to do if there are civilians between us and our enemies? Is kill them too, I guess.
Yeah, no, I think that you're hitting on something really critical here, which is the discourse belies the humanity of Palestinians. What it says is that Israel has an objective. It has an a military objective, and whatever stands in the way is really irrelevant. And that, of course, only carries any water if we accept that humanity is exceptional and only includes one people and not all people. And so now the death toll has reached 1,106 Palestinians. 80% of that number are civilians. That means 80% have not picked up arms, have not participated in any military activity, have not participated in anything that threatens Israel's security. And 200 of those are children, right? And rather than completely this just being abominable and unacceptable under any circumstances, the discourse is one that attempts to obfuscate this either in racist rhetoric, suggesting that Hamas is hiding amongst these civilians or that Hamas is using the dead in order to bolster its morality in the war, or that Palestinians themselves have a culture of martyrdom and seek to die. So either we're discussing this in racist lens to rationalize why so many Palestinians have been dead, or we're rationalizing it as a necessary evil because Israel had to attack military installations and civilians happened to be in the way. In both instances, what's happening is that we are allowing Israel to get away with absolutely no accountability, that somehow the well-being of Israeli people is necessary at all costs, and even at the cost of this dehumanization. Now, I'm saying this because I think it's really the most important point. The other point is the fact that this is just a talking point, right? That's what's being sold. That's what's being bartered. And unfortunately, you know, this has weight. And the reason I wrote the article is because I found that mainstream news anchors weren't challenging this either as a matter of morality, that it's either racist or just illogical, or as a matter of fact, the fact that it's just not true. Hamas's use of what they say is human shields or Hamas shooting from densely populated civilian areas does happen. But it happens as an exceptional case, not as a systematic one. So it cannot explain the high death toll. And even if it could explain it, it still does not justify the high death toll. But reports by Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, Physicians for Human Rights Israel, Breaking the Silence, a group of Israeli soldiers, as well as two UN reports in 1996 and another UN report in 2009, have all demonstrated that Israel targets civilians and that Hamas did not use civilians as human shields. Not a single news anchor has cited these reports. Not a single news anchor has challenged an Israeli spokesperson or someone discussing these issues to say, but wait, where is the evidence? If all of these reports, if the UN and Israelis and human rights organizations are all saying that this is not true, that Israel targets civilians and Hamas is not human shields, then why should we believe you? And the only response that they're able to give is that because the Israeli army can show you pictures. But if you look at that, we are asked to believe an Israeli a military force that is meting out destruction above everybody else in the international community. And this has not caused any kind of panic. I mean, it should cause panic, but it's not even causing alarm or pause.
Well, what pictures have they even released? The only pictures I've seen released by the Israelis are cartoons that just show, look, this is what a house with a Hamas and a kid and some weapons would look like if we lived in Simpsons land or something.
No, and this is what makes it even more difficult to digest, that what the Israeli army is producing wouldn't withstand judicial scrutiny. It only withstands public scrutiny because there are enough people that want to believe it. Mm-hmm. There are enough people that believe that Palestinian life is worth so little that this can possibly make any sense.
Well, you know, what's
at the heart of this.
I think what happens because of the lack of evidence, just like when they were lying us into war with Iraq, what happens is people fill in the spaces themselves with their imagination based on the premise that what I'm hearing must be true. So then they just start imagining all Hamas fighters carrying civilians around with them or some kind of thing like that, hiding out in civilian homes just because they've heard it so much. They just imagine it. That fills in for the evidence as long as no one's contradicting it where they can hear it contradicted. Then it sounds like it's just perfectly true. You cite Human Rights Watch in your article here at thenation.com, and I saw one of their representatives, I believe it was their president, actually on CNN today, and he was saying, you know, that what they're doing is they're being really elastic with the definition, and they're trying to pretend that just the fact that Hamas is fighting in an urban area near civilians means that somehow they're using those civilians as shields. But that's just not true. And when it comes to any specific use of human shields and the actual definition of that term, there's no evidence of it whatsoever. As you point out, there is, in fact, evidence in the past of the Israelis tying Palestinians to the hoods of their trucks, literally using them as human shields. That's the only evidence we have of this at all in this entire conflict, going back a couple years, but still.
No, I mean, I'm really, you know, happy to hear that there was some challenge of this. But what's happened and what's happened systematically is that there is a devaluation of Palestinian life. And the way that it functions in the U.S., the reason we don't even get to a discussion of, no one's asking, why would Hamas continue to shoot ineffective rockets that cause no military harm, right? And bears no military advantage, because if you're thinking about belligerence and warfare, there's no military advantage to these rockets, and yet there is severe consequences that Israel is allowed to get away with. Why would they continue that? Now, what Israel wants us to believe is that they would continue that because they're just irrational Jew haters, right? That we're supposed to believe that there are people that hate another people so much that they would do this even to the point of self-annihilation and self-sacrifice. You can only believe that if you believe that there are people like that in the world, and I feel that this is it's part of the manufacturing of Islamophobia, of manufacturing an image of Palestinians, of Arabs, who are actually Christians and Druze and other religions, right? But manufacturing them first all as Muslims and then manufacturing all Muslims as irrational and as hell-bent on death and destruction and a clash of civilizations, which is not true. What we're missing is the context that Israel is occupying the Palestinian people and has been colonizing their land and colonizing their lives since 1948, and created a refugee population of 6.6 million, and has created a situation under military occupation and apartheid where Palestinians do not have horizons of actually fulfilling their life. They are not allowed to govern themselves, nor are they allowed basic freedoms like the freedom of mobility, the freedom of earning a livelihood, the freedom of an education, the freedom of work, the freedom of living with your family in stability. All of that has been denied to Palestinians systematically for decades. And in the Gaza Strip, we're seeing its worst form, because not only are they denied that, but the Gaza Strip has also been subject to an 8-year brutal siege that has impoverished the population to the point where 80% of the Palestinian population, we're talking about nearly 2 million people, 80% of them survive on food aid from humanitarian agencies just to survive. Not because they can't work, not because they don't want to, but because Israel has sealed the waters so that fishermen cannot fish. They've sealed the land borders so that Palestinians cannot travel for work. They've made the agricultural land into military buffer zones so that they cannot farm their land. They've prevented them from engaging in any kind of trade of import and export. The World Health Organization says that the Gaza Strip will be unlivable by the year 2020. That means in 6 years, Israel would have made the Gaza Strip an entirely barren land. It would have turned it into Mars, where human survival is impossible. And so why then, under these circumstances, would a people shoot these indiscriminate rockets at this high personal cost to themselves? Why aren't we asking that question? Because what it looks like is they have nothing left to lose. Does that mean that I think they should be doing it? No, but I'm at a loss of what they should be doing.
Yeah. Well,
what should they be doing?
I've been reading quotes from regular civilians there in Gaza who are saying that they support, and this, you know, you could have written the script, it's predictable enough, that they support, they're against the ceasefire on current terms. They would rather keep fighting, and if ceasefire means going back to the status quo and the siege, something has to give here. It's a living death. I've seen that a few times. I guess that's a talking point going around. But as you describe it, it's true, and it sure makes sense that this is, if it was a scam for how do you get the average schmo in Gaza to go ahead and end up supporting Hamas and violence, you do this. So that's exactly how to do it.
You know, well,
make
no,
them
but
this
even, like,
helpless
that,
and
that
hopeless.
Misses the point. That also misses the point that Hamas is a political party with a militant wing. And Hamas was only created in 1987. But Israel has been occupying the Gaza Strip since 1967. Mm. There was no Hamas for 20 years. And even after Hamas came into power, it wasn't as powerful as Yasser Arafat and Fatah and Abu Mazen, these Palestinian leaders of Fatah. And Israel has called them no partners for peace. They have not been interested, and they've always created a Palestinian boogeyman to avoid the main issue. Once Hamas emerged as actually the best boogeyman, they've now abandoned that. But even Palestinian president in the West Bank, who has been the most compliant Palestinian leader and has even participated with, coordinated with Israel's security to protect the settlers against Palestinians and to protect the occupation against Palestinians rather than to protect the Palestinians from occupation, there's no state either, and there are no rockets. And so we should be asking ourselves, what is actually going on? If the violence is the reason, is the problem, then why has peace and the security coordination and the most compliant Palestinian regime also been able to achieve nothing according to Israel? Why has Netanyahu said there will never be a two-state solution, even though Palestinians have cooperated and bent over backwards? And so the problem is with our news cycle is that rather than addressing these questions, we're lazily relying on racist assumptions. We're lazily pointing to the spectacle rather than dealing with the root causes. To actually, if we're interested in a viable solution, that's what we would be doing.
Mm-hmm. All right, now I know you're in a hurry, but then again, you sound like you like talking about this stuff. Can I ask you one more thing, or do you have to go?
You can ask me one more thing, but I do have to go, so it'll be a quick answer.
Okay, so as quickly as you can, I was hoping you could address point number two in your article here. Again, it's 5 Israeli talking points on Gaza debunked at thenation.com. Israel pulled out of Gaza in 2005. Now, without getting entirely into the Gaza bombshell article by David Rose and the attempted coup and all that, I was hoping that, because this just makes it take too long and too complicated, but I was hoping you could somehow fill in the gap. There's a very prominent Israeli talking point, of course, that, look, we withdrew from Gaza, and then, yeah, it's under siege now, but that's only because after we withdrew, paradise wasn't good enough for evil Hamas, and they just started launching rockets at us for
yeah,
no good reason. That was why
true.
We had to put them under the siege. So I was wondering if you could...
Palestinians have never enjoyed a day of self-rule. They withdrew their settlers from Gaza. They withdrew 8,000 settlers and the military that protected them from the Gaza Strip, which is
and
only
yet there wasn't a real full-scale siege
squared.
For a couple of years, right? So
no,
what about that meantime?
What about
there was
but
the election?
This is what I'm saying. They maintained control of the electromagnetic sphere, of the airspace, of the naval space, of the entries and the exits, of the population registry. They maintained the ability to reinvade at any time. Under international law, occupation does not require a military presence. It requires a military capability and the ability to exercise effective control. Even before the siege, Israel maintained that effective control, and Palestinians never governed themselves. Mm-hmm. The siege was imposed in January 2006. That is, between the time of Hamas's parliamentary victory and the siege was not even a few months. And in that interim, there was Israel maintained its effective control and its occupation. Palestinians have never governed themselves. That is an absolute talking point, and it is meant to obfuscate this reality.
Mm. Well, and then, well, hell, as long as we're at it, if you got 1 second, go ahead and talk about the Gaza bombshell, how America, Israel, and Egypt worked to arm Fatah to overthrow and do a coup against Hamas, and that was what ended up with Hamas having monopoly rule in Gaza. Well, as a subsidiary force to the IDF, of course, but that was what led to their monopoly as compared to Fatah, of course, and ended up getting Fatah kicked out of Gaza and back
well,
to
I
the
think
West
you
Bank.
Said it. I think you said it really well. I don't think there's anything there to add. That we have been involved, the U.S., has certainly been involved in intervening in ways that have been detrimental to bring about the results that we don't like, and then we don't like these results, and we make these really irresponsible decisions that have high civilian costs mm-hmm. to an entire population, and then we don't take responsibility for it, but we only make the situation worse.
Okay, well, thank you again for your time. I really appreciate it, Nora.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate you for having me.
Okay, everybody, that is Nora Erekat. She's at thenation.com. 5 Israeli talking points on Gaza debunked. And what I was trying to say before is this isn't some flimsy listicle. This is a really good article for you, okay? 5 Israeli talking points on Gaza debunked in The Nation. All right. Oops. So, now, listen, I want to point you to this thing in the Daily Beast today. I referred to this before, but you gotta know about it. Israel creates no man's land in Gaza, shrinking the strip by 40%. By 40%! This article is by Jesse Rosenfeld at the Daily Beast. And, in fact, well, hell, I had his bio here a minute ago. He's written for every newspaper under the sun, okay? He's a real-ass journalist. Here he is. He's written for The Nation, The Guardian, Al Jazeera, The Toronto Star, The National, Le Monde, okay? He's a reporter. Israel creates no man's land in Gaza, shrinking the strip by 40%. Wow. To protect itself from Hamas rockets and tunnels. You can see how objective his reporting is here. how, quote-unquote, objective. To protect itself from Hamas rockets and tunnels, Israel is forcing tens of thousands of people out of their homes, turning their old neighborhoods into a no-man's land. This narrow strip of land that used to be called the Gaza Strip, already one of the more densely populated places on Earth, is growing dramatically smaller. The Israeli military, relentlessly and methodically, is driving people out of the 3-kilometer, that's 1.8-mile buffer zone it says it needs to protect against Hamas rockets and tunnels. According to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, the buffer zone eats up about 44% of Gaza's territory. What that means on the ground is scenes of extraordinary devastation in places like the Al-Shajia district approaching Gaza's eastern frontier and Beit Hanun in the north. These were crowded neighborhoods less than 3 weeks ago. Now they have been literally depopulated. The residents joining more than 160,000 internally displaced people in refuges and makeshift shelters. Apartment blocks are fields of rubble. And as I moved through this hostile landscape, the phrase that keeps ringing in my head is scorched earth. Again, reports Jesse Rosenfeld at the Daily Beast. It's not like Israel didn't plan this. It told tens of thousands of Palestinians to flee so its air force, artillery, and tanks could create this uninhabitable no-man's land of half-standing, burned-out buildings, broken concrete, and twisted metal. During a brief humanitarian ceasefire, some Gazans were able to come back to get their first glimpse of the destruction this war has brought to their communities and to sift through their demolished homes to gather clothes or other scattered bits of their past lives. But many were not even able to do that. When Rania Hales got within 60 feet of the debris that was once her family home in Al-Shajia on Saturday, a machine gun on top of a nearby Israeli Merkava tank started firing. Probably these were warning shots pumped in her direction, but the 42-year-old mother of seven ran for her life. Now she stays with her family in an overcrowded parking garage in Gaza City, soon to be collapsed by Israeli bombs, right? And spends her days sitting in a public park full of refugees displaced by the Israeli push. Normally these would be festive times. The end of Ramadan is at hand and celebrations akin in spirit to Christmas festivities are beginning. But holidays have a way of intensifying tragedy. There is no place for Hale's family to gather to give gifts and eat Palestinian sweets. There is, in fact, no place for them at all. We've lost our homes and now we live in the streets, she said. Here, let me skip the personal narrative to get to more of the point here. The whole neighborhood, she can't even find where her home used to be. The whole neighborhood is completely level. She can't even tell one former street from the next. It's completely unrecognizable. And then, yeah, and then the presence of death, he says. In Beit Hanun, the systematic destruction mirrors Al-Shajia. I walk past old men and teenagers trying to lift up cinder blocks and slabs of stucco with their bare hands, sometimes in search of mattresses and others in search of a relative. Scorched earth historically means destroying land to deprive the encroaching enemy of its use. Israelis shy away from using the phrase to describe what they are doing because in Israel, it brings to mind, yeah, and the rest of the world too, it brings to mind the strategy of the Nazi retreat from Russia at the end of the Second World War. According to the Hebrew University political scientist, I thought that was mostly the Russians' retreat from the Nazis. I guess the Nazis did the same thing, retreating from the Russians, huh? The hell do I know? According to Hebrew University political scientist and well, the Russians retreated first, and then they pushed back. Yeah. According to Hebrew University political scientist and longtime analyst of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Yaron Ezrahi. Oh, man, did I blow the break again? Damn it. With or without the phrase, the idea does have a certain logic. Ezrahi says there is a military and political calculation behind this devastation. Some in the Israeli government believe it will create enough Palestinian suffering so that Gazans will rise up against Hamas or force the leaders to come to terms with Israel when they come out of hiding. There you go. Dictionary definition of terrorism. Right there. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at wallstreetwindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself, wallstreetwindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show here. Boy, I blew that break. I'm really bad at doing radio, I admit it. Cut me some slack. Here's the one quote I wanted to share with you from this article today about how they're seizing a 2-mile strip, reducing the size of Gaza by 40%, according to this article in the Daily Beast. His source here, one of his sources is a political scientist at Hebrew University, Yaron Ezrahi, saying that one of their calculations is they're trying to create enough Palestinian suffering so that Gazans will rise up against Hamas or force the leaders to come to terms with Israel when they come out of hiding. So they say that they're specifically targeting only bad guys and they only ever accidentally kill civilians and only because Hamas uses civilians as human shields and all this. But at other times, they admit that the accusation is exactly the fact. It's a deliberate policy of attempting to terrorize the civilian population of Gaza into making the political decisions, the political calculations the Israelis would have them make about who to support as their so-called leadership over there. And that's why they keep blowing up those kids to death over there. So don't be confused about it. They admit it. That's the policy. You can read Jesse Rosenfeld today in the Daily Beast about it. Israel shrinks Gaza by 40%. And the war's not over yet. All right. Now, I'm sorry, we go on to our next guest today. It's Ken Klippenstein. And I'm sorry, Ken, is it Stein or Steen?
It's Stein.
Okay, it is Stein. Well, that was my first guess. So good. Ken Klippenstein, he's writing here for with Paul Gottinger again for Truth Out. That's truthout.org. U.S. provides Israel the weapons used on Gaza. And, of course, everybody knows that, but not everybody knows what's all in here. Please break it down for us, Ken.
Well, it's pretty ugly, unfortunately. The largest portion of U.S. weapons exports to Israel turns out to be precisely the same categories of weapons that Israel is using to kill Gazans right now. And so the largest portion, when I broke it down from the publicly available U.S. Census Bureau export data, turns out to be military airplanes and military helicopters. The second largest portion for 2013, for the year 2013, was cartridges and parts of cartridges for guns. And then the third largest one was bombs, grenades, and torpedoes. Now, if we take a look back at 2014, what's available now for about the first 4 months of the year, again, the largest portion is military airplanes and military helicopters. Second largest portion is military transport planes. And then the third largest portion is armored fighting vehicles, which would include howitzers and perhaps the tanks that they're invading Gaza with right now.
Man, so that's really incredible. And everybody, if you go to truthout.org and you pull up this article again, it's called U.S. Provides Israel the Weapons Used on Gaza. There's your keyword, provides. You know, you find that in there. Google, pull it right up for you, or whichever is your favorite search engine. And you got all the pie charts here, all the data, hot links to all the information here. And now let's see. Oh, that includes the howitzers. Did you mention the howitzers, M109? How accurate are those things? I mean, I guess I know it's a matter of trigonometry, but they sure do seem to kill a lot of people.
Well, unfortunately, they like to use words like a surgical strike, and you know, they talk about laser-guided missiles and all these things. But if you actually, a figure came out earlier this week finding that 70% of the dead are civilians, and so you have to question how accurate these are, if in fact they're not intending to target civilians, because as you point out, this is part of a strategy to destabilize Gaza to the point that they'll overthrow their leadership, because Israel's not happy with the leadership.
Yeah, well, and it doesn't seem to be working, but anyway, yeah, that sure does seem to be their policy. And now, you know what's interesting to me about U.S. aid to Israel here, and you link to the Federation of American Scientists there, talking about the $3 billion a year. You know, it's, as I'm sure you're aware, it's written in the Constitution that the Congress is forbidden from appropriating money for whatever you call your Defense Department, right, for the Army, the Navy, et cetera, for more than 2 years at a time. And they're not allowed to do any 5-year or 10-year plan or anything like that for the military. And that's supposed to be a little bit of a check and balance on having a permanent standing army and a Spartan way of life around here. And yet, in the more literal sense of that term, and yet they're perfectly happy to pass a law earmarking $30 billion over 10 years for the Israeli military.
That's exactly correct. And I don't think there's any better way to highlight the policy continuity, the way in which Bush and Obama's foreign policy is practically identical, than looking at their Israel policy. So what Bush did was he passed a $30 billion, as you pointed out, over 10-year military aid. This is formal military aid. This doesn't include all the other kinds of military aid that they label and designate with different terms. And Obama hasn't passed a formal law, but he's upheld the precisely the same amount. So they're exactly the same on the Israel issue, both presidents.
Yep. And yeah, speaking of that missile defense thing, I don't know if you saw the clip of Jon Stewart, mocking the Israeli government for their denunciations of John Kerry, where one of these Israeli politicians went as far as to basically call John Kerry a terrorist or say his proposed ceasefire was in effect a terrorist attack against Israel. And Jon Stewart is talking about how, John Kerry, the terrorist, committing terrorist attacks at the same time he's paid for the entire Iron Dome system that's protecting Israel from the rockets that are coming in here. And it's just even Jon Stewart, who usually doesn't go too far on these kinds of issues,
right,
can't help but point out, like, boy, talk about biting the hand that feeds you in the middle of this thing, for crying out loud. You know?
Right. Exactly. I think the Israeli policy towards Gaza is becoming so vulgar that you're even starting to see some pretty some normally pretty tepid critics of Israel come out with much stronger attacks. One example being Jon Stewart, of course.
Yeah, that's exactly the term I was looking for there. Vulgar is exactly what it is. Like, hey, guys, take it down just a notch, right?
exactly.
Jeez, somebody hire a new PR guy over there.
Right. You can colonize Gaza. You can do whatever you like with it, but just tone down the whole killing of the kids thing. That's getting a little far.
Yeah. Well, you know, the military's experimenting on the drugs that make you lose your conscience. So I was thinking if I could get some of that, then I could get a job doing PR for Israel and probably do pretty well in that industry.
Get a job with the DOD, huh?
Yeah. I mean, come on. Their lie departments are falling way behind the times here. We got apps for debunking this stuff now, you know?
That's exactly right.
Let's talk about, as you mentioned in your article here a little bit, the criticisms, something we talked about with a previous guest as well. But the criticisms that the Israeli government has come under from the United Nations and other international institutions for attacking medical facilities and other civilian infrastructures. I don't know exactly. When the Security Council said anything, but somebody was... some governments have been denouncing the Israelis for going too far this time, no?
That's correct. And if you look at it, the UN tried to establish a formal inquiry into whether or not Israel has committed war crimes in Gaza. And if you look at it, the one member state that voted against the inquiry was the United States. And so, I mean, one has to ask oneself, why wouldn't you want to have an inquiry in it if you are confident that they haven't done it? Of course, Israel wasn't included in the vote since they're one of the two countries involved in this particular conflict.
Right. Yeah. Well, everything they do displays that guilty conscience. We'll stay in Iraq, but you got to give us immunity for the war crimes we're going to commit there.
Right.
You know, otherwise,
right.
What are we supposed to do? Run around committing war crimes without immunity? I mean, we can't have that.
And when you talk to the experts on it, I mean, it's pretty much taken for granted. I talked to the he was the UN specialist on the Palestinian territories.
Mm-hmm. Oh, save that thought until right after this break. It's Ken Klippenstein from truthout.org. He's got this article with Paul Gottinger. U.S. provides Israel the weapons used on Gaza. More in just a minute. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code SCOTT when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys. Welcome to the show. Back to it, I mean. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. Wrapping up today with Ken Klippenstein. Did I say Steen last time? I'm terrible about that. Ken Klippenstein, he's at truthout.org. That's truthout.org. U.S. provides Israel the weapons used on Gaza. I'm sorry, interrupted by the heartbreak like every time on this show. Ken, just keeps happening. But you were saying the U.N. expert that you talked to was explaining about the consequences for the civilians there in Gaza.
Right. If you look at the experts in the matter, they practically take for granted that Israel is guilty of war crimes. So I was talking to the UN specialist on the Palestinian territories. He was the specialist for a number of years up until just about a couple months ago. And he said, given all the evidence, it's pretty clear that Israel is guilty of war crimes. You know, bombing hospitals, bombing ambulances, bombing UN shelters, which incidentally, there's tens of thousands of Gazans in UN shelters right now. So many that... there's no space for any more. And exacerbating the problem, I came on the show earlier, about a month ago, and we discussed the military coup in Egypt. Well, it turns out that that has a huge bearing on the Gazan situation because the new regime in Egypt has actually closed a border that has traditionally been used to allow Gazan refugees out of the area when they're being bombed by Israel. Mm-hmm. And so now that he's closed it, they're not able to leave it to seek medical attention or even just wait for the bombing to finish.
Right. Well, and it's worse than even in the Mubarak times, never mind when the Muslim Brotherhood was there. And they only actually loosened up that border a little bit. It's not like they just opened it up wide or anything. But what I'm hearing from Rafah, from, in fact, the Egyptian side of the border, is the clampdown is far worse than it was even during Mubarak times. And I'm talking about before the recent last 3 weeks of one-sided warfare, but just, you know, if you went back 6 weeks or whatever.
Yes, that's exactly correct. And if you look at something else that Sisi did, the new military leader, the moment he came to power, they destroyed these tunnels running underground beneath... Gaza and Egypt. And what these tunnels are is a sort of vital hub for commerce, since the Israeli blockade on Gaza doesn't allow them to sort of import goods, which is really the right of any territory, any sovereign territory. It's according to the Gazan economic minister, I believe he estimated that it's caused a decrease of 40% in the government revenue. So this is have a devastating effect on the Gazan economy.
Yeah. Well, and here's the other thing, too, man, is if you're talking about Coca-Cola or Levi's jeans, there's no or Hollywood movies, there's no mistaking the connection to the middle part of North America. That's where this stuff comes from. Same thing for F-16s and M-16s. These are symbols of America. It's not just that they're ruthlessly, you know, effective military hardware, but they don't have to have, you know, USA serial numbers on them. There's no mistaking, you know, who's behind the military of Israel. And we've already paid for that in terrorist attacks. It seems, you know, inescapable that we're going to see more terrorists attacking the United States based on what we are helping the Israelis do to the Palestinians.
I think you bring up a very important point. It would seem like there's no better policy to pursue to ensure terrorism against the West than by killing 70% civilians, many of them children and the elderly.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess we don't really need to point out that the state and its cronies do tend to fail for their own interests and continue on in their folly, as in this case, as with anything else, but I guess I just did point it out. But yeah, and so it continues on, and I think that's a really big thing. All around the world, people are looking at this And it's amazing to see the polls from around the world where it's only the American people who are buying this. Everywhere else in the world, they have the slightest even balanced coverage of it, and public opinion snaps entirely the other way. Wait, who's occupying who again?
That's correct. The claim that Gaza has, as John Kerry said, the Palestinians have besieged Israel. Well, if you look at a map for half a second, you realize that's completely ridiculous.
Yeah, it's just amazing for them to try to... Well, and I guess that's all they have, is to just try to completely turn around. It's like that article I'm still trying to get this author on in the Salon.com wrote about the Israeli Hasbara manual that recommends, for example, that when describing the occupation of the West Bank, you got to cast it in terms of the Jim Crow South. Okay, I'm with you so far. And then they say, yeah, because the Arabs are the white supremacists and the Jews are the blacks who aren't allowed to just live wherever they want in peace in the West Bank. Without, and never even mind whose country is whose and what's occupied territory and
right,
you know,
right,
stealing the water and all this. Just never even mind any of that, right? It's all already Israel, only this is the Arab supremacist part of it somehow or something.
What we're seeing here is like a really old, like almost like pre-19th century form of colonialism that I think the global public just doesn't accept anymore. And so for that reason, as you point out, propaganda is really important in order to be able to maintain this kind of thing.
Right. And I think that's why the pro-Israeli factions have been kind of panicking about how they're losing the war for public opinion in America. You know, again, of course, that social media they like to cite as their evidence all the time sure does seem to be getting the job done, basically. It's a great equalizer between the news consumer and provider. And... where they have cracked down on media for doing a good job, they've had to take it back in many of the cases anyway. Most famously, of course, in the case of NBC, but it seems like there's finally a little bit of accountability because of the internet here.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's opened up an entire new form of dissent, of which you are a part, and of course many other people are.
Yeah,
and I think that's important for challenging the dominant narratives.
Right. All right. So now let's get back into some of these numbers here about the, if you have the article in front of you, can you talk about the numbers of F-16s and tanks and rifles and all this kinds of things so we can get kind of an idea of just how much of their military is dependent on our aid?
Sure thing. And I should preface this with the acknowledgement that these are the publicly available figures. And so this is probably a vast understatement. I actually spoke to an arms specialist named Andrew Feinstein. He was a minister of parliament in South Africa for a while, where he tried to challenge some of the worst abuses of these arms trafficking regimes, mm-hmm, like the U.S. And what he told me is that the figures that we see are just the absolute minimum, because it doesn't include all these other forms of military aid that just get called defense or, you know, other things. So take, for instance, the missile defense system. Well, there's a new report coming out of MIT finding that it doesn't actually defend against the missiles. It only stops maybe 5% of them. And then the ones that it does stop, it tends to have an even worse effect, because when their missiles hit the rockets, they explode and have a sort of shrapnel effect that can harm people worse than if the rocket itself had just landed. And so that's falsely labeled defense, even though it has no discernible no serious discernible defense capability. And that's something that we're sending about $500 million in order to support. But looking at the specific figures, that's a report coming out of MIT. You can look at it online. But looking at the specific figures, in the fiscal year 2013, the amount of military airplanes and helicopters that was the largest portion was $196 million. And then you look at some of the smaller figures, like cartridges for weapons, that's $30 million. Bombs, grenades, and torpedoes, that's $25 million. Guided missiles, which might be used by the F-16s they're using to hit Gaza and Homs, that's $10 million. Warships is $10 million. Rocket launchers and similar projectors are $11 million. And then you have revolvers and pistols for another $11 million. Mm-hmm. Now, if we look at 2014, which we only have a couple months of data in for, you see roughly the same pattern. The largest portion dedicated to military airplanes and helicopters at $91 million so far, and then military transport planes at $64 million. Armored fighting vehicles, which would include howitzers that you mentioned before, that's $39 million. rocket projectors at 9 million, then warships at 10 million, and then a few smaller ones like the revolvers and pistols at about 7 million.
Yeah. So I don't know how that compares to how much they're spending in their own budget. And, of course, dollars are fungible. So in a way, we're going to finance their socialized medicine and every other thing, too, that Americans may or may not be for. But I don't know how much it compares to their military spending. That sure sounds like a big chunk of it anyway, huh?
Yeah, if you look at the comparative economic figures, the U.S. GDP is $16 trillion. And then if you look at the Israeli one, it's barely $300 billion.
And do you know what percentage of their military expenditure we're picking up the slack for there?
Oh, I would imagine an enormous amount. I mean, yeah. Israel is basically a U.S. base in the Middle East.
Yep, afraid so. All right, thank you very much, Ken. I sure appreciate it.
Okay, thanks for having me on.
Sure. I think America might be an Israeli base in North America. Yeah. We'll be back in a second. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com.